Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Peter Doyle is the author of Echo and Reverb, Fabricating Space in Popular Music Recording 1900 to 1960. Doyle's book is the first history of acoustically imagined space in popular music recording. He talked to Steve Paulson about the history of echo and reverb, starting with an explanation of the difference between them.
They're the same physical phenomenon. Echo is the single bounce of the sound. You shout out into the canyon and you hear the same shout come back to you. It's distinct and discreet. Whereas reverb or reverberation is that kind of washy, messed up piling on of echoes so that it's just a general kind of tail on the sound, if you like.
Well, let's talk about some of the songs that you have written about, starting with Robert Johnson's 1936 recording, Come On In My Kitchen. How does Robert Johnson use echo and reverb in this song, Come On In My Kitchen?
It's way out of its time, that record. It's about how cruel the world is, and he's sort of offering this little kind of refuge, come on in my kitchen, it's going to be raining outdoors. And then he does this little interlude where he says, hear the wind howl, and does a little slide guitar lick. And then he mutters, you know, he really mutters, it's at such low amplitude that the mic hardly picks it up, really. It wasn't really correct for the technology of 1936 or whatever, just recording in a hotel room. But he mutters as though he's got the technology we're used to. Baby, can you hear the wind howl, or whatever the exact words are.
Baby, can't you hear that wind howl? Oh, can't you hear that wind howl?
And he does this sort of thing like an almost, I think it's like an oral, a sonic close-up, you know. He's kind of really zeroing in, and he plays this really kind of very delicate lick on the guitar. Then you hear his bottleneck sort of accidentally bumps against the fretboard of the guitar. There seems to be so much going on in that. It's like he's aware of his audience there and saying, come a little bit closer, you know, just zone in a little bit more on this. There's all the sort of legends about Johnson, how he, when he recorded that in a hotel room in San Antonio, Texas, you know, just a makeshift studio, for reasons that are much argued about, but no one really knows, he faced into the corner of the room as he did that, whether it was shyness or a sense of privacy about his guitar playing technique or whatever. One of the theories is that it was a little acoustic engineering technique so that the sound would sort of bounce off the walls right in front of him. Use the reverberation from the walls just to kind of boost his sound a little bit. You know, we really don't know, but there seems to be such an intensity in that moment, in every sense of the word, a kind of intensity in the meaning of the song. He draws his listeners into a kind of more intense engagement with the record. Yeah, that kind of concentration into the corner there.
Well, and the effect is something very haunting. And, I mean, the thing that they say about Robert Johnson is, you know, he somehow evoked some part of him, some part of his soul that was extraordinary. I mean, you rarely hear it, and you hear it in this song.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I guess what I'm interested in that is how really materially he does that, because we feel that. The first time I ever heard that when I was a teenager was that moment of the song, you know, and wow, I've just never heard anything like that. And it's, you know, it's fascinated me ever since. There are real things he's doing. It's not just magic. It's deliberate.
You better come on in my kitchen. Cause it's going to be raining outdoors.
Now, a very different use of echo and reverb comes later with a song like Rosemary Clooney's Hey There, a 1954 recording, where she actually uses this technology to evoke the inner thoughts of someone.
Yeah, there's a few sort of things like that from the late 40s, early 50s, where female pop singers, they were recording onto tape then, so it was pretty easy to double, triple, quadruple track and re-record and sing back with yourself and all that sort of thing. So they started sort of multiplying women's voices and started splitting it up so that one voice would be the conscious self and the other one is the conscience or whatever. And so there's numerous examples from the time, but they'd often put the secondary voice, also give it a kind of big echoey, reverby kind of embellishment to make it more like it's coming from the depths of the soul or something like that.
Well, and you create the sense of multiple personalities. I mean, you have kind of the authentic voice or the voice that everyone kind of associates with in normal life. And then you have this kind of otherworldly, almost sort of movie quality voice that is kind of mysterious and inward looking.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes.
Are you talking to me?
Love never made a fool of you.
Not until now.
You used to be too wise.
Yes, I was once.
Let's talk about another big pop hit. I think another 1950s song, Les Paul and Mary Ford's How High the Moon, which was, I think, a million-selling song.
Yeah, that's a funny thing. It was a million-selling song. In that little period after World War II and before the coming of rock and roll, record sales were generally not great. The pop music industry sort of was in a slump after the war, which it remained in until the coming of rock and roll. But the few records that sold really spectacularly, you know, in the US and throughout the world, often were semi-novelty or tricked-up kind of records. And Les Paul and Mary Ford, How High the Moon, was one of them. You know, it was so unlike its contemporaries in how careful and sophisticated it was with multi-tracking and the use of echo and counterpointing dry on-mic sounds with off-mic sounds. It's a tour de force of technological manipulation.
So is that what it is? Does the credit go to the technical wizards behind the scene as opposed to just the people, you know, the singers?
How High the Moon by Les Paul and Mary Ford really rocks. It's got a fabulous drive to it. That's to me when the effect really happens. It's working with just fabulous playing and it's got the really lovely bell-like guitar sounds from Les Paul, the kind of sound he was so good at. Some people might even find it almost too clean by the kind of modern, more distorted standards of guitar sound that we're used to. But Paul used a very, very clean, ringing sort of tone, but that with the kind of really nice driving rhythm guitar that Mary Ford played, actually. It's kind of simple, and the reverb and echo effects just kind of make all these snaps and crackles and pops happen all over the thing. And it's kind of tricksy, but it works.
Until you will, I still my heart.
Now, there's another song that you write about that has assumed a kind of a legendary status in the history of rock and roll, and that's Elvis Presley's Mystery Train, which was his last single he did for Sun Records in 1955. What is so significant about the echo and reverb that he's using there?
That's one where questions of the space and place and movement and mobility, you know, the whole song is about that. The archaeology of the use of echo and reverb on recordings. You know, it goes back to a sort of a setting up of a fake space in a way. So when you add reverb, add echo, you're kind of imputing physical dimensions that may or may not be there.
Are you talking about evoking the sound of the train in the background with that guitar?
In Mystery Train, the guitar has this sort of slapback echo effect on it that Scotty Moore played. It's just a very simple but exquisitely catchy lick people still are fascinated by. But then there's this other weird stuff happening where it's a song that uses verses, free-floating verses. A lot of them had been around for decades and decades in other sort of folk tunes songs. But it's got no coherent spatiality to it in a way. He's on the train. He's waiting for the train to arrive. He's seeing it coming around the bend. He's seeing it leaving. You know, what's going on here? Where's he? Where are we? What space is this coming from? And, you know, there's no answer to that. There is no single coherent spatial regime there. And I think that's really kind of what started happening with rock and roll. There's so much new that was ushered in by Elvis Presley and all the other people, rock and roll and rhythm and blues of the mid-50s and early 50s. But one of the things that they really did do, I think, they used a lot of these technological sort of tricks and techniques that were around, already available, but they were under no compunction to make sense, to be coherent, to sort of paint a picture. So it was just a sort of disordered, kind of anarchistic sort of space that was proposed. And I think Presley really did that. And I think if you listen back to the recordings, that really is happening. You know, it's not just hype about early 50s rock and roll. There is really something materially there that's going on. It's traceable.
Peter Doyle is the author of Echo and Reverb, Fabricating Space in Popular Music Recording 1900 to 1960. He spoke with Steve Paulson.